Good afternoon. My name is Bill Jordan from Baylor University. I'd like to welcome you to the first of two sessions that are labeled engineering. There's one now. Obviously, this one tomorrow morning, there's one labeled engineering and appropriate technology.
Thank you.
The one thing I want to say, if you're an engineer interested in engineering, is we've got engineers speaking in all sorts of sessions that aren't labeled engineering. Now, even just this afternoon, there's an engineer speaking in the ethics, environment, and economics. There's another engineer speaking in science literacy, and another engineer speaking in theology this afternoon. So engineers are in a wide variety. I would also be remiss if I didn't say welcome to my alma mater. I have 2 degrees from the Carter School of Mines. So far, every building we've been in, except the banquet last night, was not here when I was in. Totally different. But the banquet place was built just before I graduated. Welcome to Mines. Mines was a big deal for me, and I'm really glad that ASA has come back to it. So without any further ado, our first speaker is Jonathan Turiak, talking about current and future approaches to brain-computer interface technology. John?
All right. Thank you, Bill. Can everyone hear me? I guess I speak loud.
Good.
Okay. So this looks like it'll be an eclectic session of engineering. This is my talk will be a fusion of engineering and science. So I'm going to talk a little bit about brain-computer interface technology. Probably not many of you know what that is. So I'll go over a little bit of a definition and how it fits in with this revolution we're experiencing in physiological sensing. I'll go over a few types of BCIs and what they are. I'll give a couple of examples. And then hopefully dive into a little bit of how it works so you get a sense of the process involved. Then we'll pull back out, talk some about the reality versus what's the hype that you hear in the media, and then implications and concerns from a Christian perspective. Okay, so I don't know if anyone here has any of these devices. Anyone here wear one of these? Yeah, my Microsoft band just broke. But we are in the midst of a revolution in physiological sensing. A lot of these devices just came on the market. They are actually really interesting and incredibly powerful, and they can do a lot of things. So we've seen a real revolution in this domain, from very simple technologies like pedometers to your phone, which has GPS and three-axis accelerometry, and it can measure how far you've been, your activity during the day, to even more advanced sensors that you're now wearing in mobile technology, such as measuring of temperature or heart rate, either through ECG or PPG. That's what's on your Microsoft bands or your Apple watches. And even more sophisticated sensors are now on the market that measure effective state or stress through derivative physiological measures such as heart rate variability, how fast your heart beats, and your EDA or your skin, your galvanic skin response, how much you sweat during any particular activity. And they're moving in that direction. They're moving to more complex, more and more complex aspects with the ultimate goal of, can we have a device that now measures your cognitive state, what you're thinking, how you're feeling? This increase in physiological sensing has led to the quantified self movement. I don't know if you've heard of any of it in the media, where there are these people that are focused on self-tracking, self-knowledge through self-tracking with technology. Typically now it's focused on performance, health, activity-related things, but that's just the beginning. Okay, so what is BCI? Brain-computer interface is a pathway between the brain and the external device, a computer, and they're used for many things. In my work, I work at the U.S. Army Research Laboratory, and in my work, they're used for research purposes in human performance. But they're also used for assisting and augmenting and repairing cognitive or sensory motor functions. Usually if somebody's lost the capability either to move their arm or to speak or to communicate in any way, that's really where the genesis of this technology came from. And there are two main types of BCIs, or brain-computer interface technologies. I'll use the word BCI from now on. Well, one is invasive, where it's actually electrodes are surgically implanted on the cortical surface or penetrated into cortical structures. It's a big deal. It requires surgery. It's usually only ever used when you have a loss of function, somebody's injured, or in another way needs their function restored, and surgery is warranted. But where I work mostly is non-invasive BCI. This is where we're measuring brain activity without causing or disrupting the body. And the one I'm going to talk about today, and the most common ones, is by placing electrodes or sensors on the scalp and measuring voltage potentials. And this is used through a device called electroencephalography. That's shown in the picture on the right there. Kind of looks a little funny, but what it is like I said, voltage potentials measured on the scalp. These are really, really tiny, 10 to the minus 6 microvolts. So it is a real challenge to actually take this signal, what looks like a bunch of squiggly lines, and turn that into something meaningful. But that's exactly what this technology is designed to do. Okay, so how do these work? What are the types of VCIs? There are three main types. One is an active VCI, in which the outputs are derived from brain activity, which is consciously directed. So think left, think right, the mouse moves left, the mouse moves right, or grasp or lift, and the arm, the robotic arm raises or lowers. It's always generated from the person. The second type, and the type I'll probably focus mostly on, is reactive VCI. And it uses the outputs, brain activity arising from the reaction to a stimulus. So a stimulus is presented, usually a visual or auditory stimulus. The brain responds, you measure that response, and then infer something about the state and take action. The final type is passive VCI, which is really a continuous monitoring of brain activity to infer state, but passively so that it uses implicit interactions between the human and the computer to improve the communication or the relation between the human and the computer. This is a fairly new approach to VCIs. So, all right, so that's hopefully a little bit of a background. You guys know what a VCI is in the vaguest sense and how it fits into the broader picture of physiological sensing. So what can they do? One of the most common types is spelling. So this is a communication device. What it is, they're wearing an EEG cap. You can see sort of the squiggly lines. This is the voltage potentials on the brain. And what they'll be doing is they'll be looking at a particular letter. These different squares will be oscillating at different frequencies and phases, and the BCI will pick that up, because when you attend to a specific letter, your brain will oscillate at the frequency at which that letter is presented, and they can infer what you're looking at. So actually, there's a little video online that gives a better illustration of what I mean. So this one is from University of California, San Diego. And as you can see, it's flickering. He's looking at a letter, and his brain is oscillating at the specific phase and frequency at which he's looking at that moment, and he's typing out these words you see up top. So it can actually happen very quickly. These systems are actually pretty powerful. And as you can see, this is really useful for communication. Especially if you are unable to communicate verbally or had trouble with hand movements or other things. But there is more esoteric type of VCI, and this is where my research is involved in. This is a study that I directed a couple of years ago. And here, this was with a fairly straightforward task where the person, we brought people into the laboratory, they were presented with images, a series of images, either of novel people they'd never seen before, a famous individual or celebrity, and or personal friends or family members from which they brought us images. They were just simply looking at a rapid presentation of images, and their only job was to press a button when they saw a current or former president's face. And so we measured the brain activity. This is just quickly walking through this plot. On the x-axis, it's the time from time zero when the image was presented, 300 to 600 milliseconds after that. On the y-axis is the voltage potentials, and as you can see, the lines deviate at around 200 milliseconds after the stimulus. So after about 200 milliseconds after looking at a picture, we can tell your brain activity deviates from whether or not that's a novel person, you've never seen them before, whether or not it's a famous person which you recognize, or a close relative or associate. So this is a really interesting signal. Another way to look at it here, now you're looking down on top of the brain, the nose, this is the nose. Facing up the ears, you're looking down on the brain. The color represents the voltage activity on the scalp. And what you can just take away from this picture is that, again, these three categories, from a novel, a person you've never seen before, a famous individual, or a personal friend or family member, they produce different neural activity, and we can use that. In fact, we did use that in this study. After a single presentation of a face, we were able to classify with very high degree of accuracy whether or not you knew that person. So this is a knowledge recognition BCI. We know what you know. Okay, so that gives you some sense of the spectrum of which these types of technologies can be used. So how does it work? And so there are two main challenges with this type of technology. One is it's very low signal to noise. These are tiny, tiny, tiny signals. They can be interfered with electrical activity in the environment, 60 hertz from the overhead lights, from muscle movements. Muscles produce electrical activity, all sorts of things. And they're also very high dimensional. So what I mean is that when you're recording EEG activity, you have a number of electrodes over a small period of time, such as a single second epoch, a single second of time with 256 channel electrodes, you get a dimensional space of over 128,000 dimensions. So this is a very difficult high dimensional problem space. So how does it work? So the way it typically works is by averaging responses. So imagine here's EEG. Here's over the entire experiment design, the waving lines are the electrical activity. Every black line is, let's say, a presentation of a stimulus. And let's say there are two types of stimulus, a target red and a non-target stimulus. You take the average response in each epoch after the presentation of the stimulus, and you simply average it. And if you do so over many, many trials, you can actually begin to see the difference in neural activity from time zero to about a second difference between these two classes of stimuli. So that's great, but for BCI, it needs to happen now. It needs to happen within a second. You can't wait. You can't average over many, many trials. It needs to happen now. So what it uses is machine learning. And hopefully many of you know or are familiar with some ideas of machine learning, but this is a classic example where you can, instead of looking at the EEG this way as a series, a time series of lines, you can take the activity after each presentation of each stimulus and map it into a high dimensional space. So for example, two dimensions on two electrodes. This is an FZ electrode, a PZ electrode, which is just the name of the electrodes. Each stimulus will be a point in that space. And you can do that for all of the electrodes. Now we have 100, 200, 300 electrodes, and you get a cloud in a high dimensional space. And your job then is to separate the two classes of stimulus, the red dots from the black dots, in a very high dimensional space. And so this is exactly what machine learning is very good at, is what it's designed to do. It's designed to find a decision boundary, often termed a hyperplane, that separates two classes of stimulus, in this case two EEG signals, in this high-dimensional space. And so we use a bunch of different types of machine learning algorithms to do this, but the objective here is to find this, the ideal line that separates the red dots from the black dots. Usually it's not perfect, but the way we do this is we look for, we use algorithms that are robust, meaning they separate these points, they do it for the data from which we provided the machine to the machine learning algorithm. They also, they work now and they work in the future. They're sparse, meaning we use as few dimensions as possible, because that leads to increased robustness. You have less aspects or areas in which noise can be introduced or corrupt the signal. And they're smooth, because biological signals tend to be smooth over space and time. So we use these concepts to identify a decision boundary in this high-dimensional space. And it sort of sounds complicated and fancy, but it's actually very simple. This is an illustrative equation where you're just finding the weights that transpose the signal, the EEG signal that's coming in, to the current brain state at time t. And so a lot of work in BCI is to find the optimal way to find that decision boundary. And then once you do that, you no longer have this really high-dimensional EEG signal, the squiggly lines that go on. You have a single score or a single point which represents the distance of that epoch to the decision boundary. And so every stimulus now, you have a single score. And so if your BCI worked well, hopefully all of one class is above zero and your other class is below zero. Here, in case targets are above zero, non-targets are below zero, and you can take that number, that score, and then act upon it. So if I get a red, if I get a plus score, that means they're looking at a target or they're looking at a person they know. If I get a minus score, that means they're looking at a novel individual or someone they don't know. So, I'm playing time. All right, so that was a lot sort of the technical aspects of it. So what can it really do, right? There's a lot of engineering and the physiological sensors that goes into this. There's a lot of analysis, signal processing, and how you take these signals in, these signals that are very tiny and very easily corrupted by noise. There's a lot of work in how you interpret or infer these signals. and what machine learning tools you do, what you use to do this. So we can show you some great examples. I showed you a great video that some really cool things can happen, but what can they really do, right? Oftentimes with new technologies, there's a sense of hype or inflated expectation, and that's actually what's quantified. This is a really interesting website you can go to by Gartner Research, and they do this every year for a whole bunch of technologies. I'm just listing a few here. And they put them on this interesting continuum from the innovation trigger, when the technology becomes available, to the peak of inflated expectations, the trough of disillusionment, the slope of enlightenment, and finally the plateau of productivity. So a lot of technologies follow this cycle. I encourage you to go to the website because it's really interesting where all these technologies lie. At least a couple of them that you may be familiar with. Quantum computing is just starting, right? It's on this ramp up. Gesture-controlled devices, these are like the Kinects and things that know where your body is and you can communicate that way. Also, early on, the ubiquitous blockchain you hear about every day with Bitcoin and all the cryptocurrencies, right? That's really peaking right now. Augmented reality has now sort of suffered the crash, if you will, after Google Glass, and now is beginning to be used in industry in very specific applications. So, but right now it's sort of at its low point after the hype that we all heard with Google Glass. And finally, virtual reality. The Oculus Rift, the HTC Vive, they're everywhere now, right? They were. For many, many years, VR was sort of the next big thing, and it took many, many years to get there. There was way too much hype. Finally, they've now become a productive technology. So BCI is right there. Early in the innovation stage, it's really ramping up. There tends to be a lot of hype on such a thing, but we are at an inflection point, and this technology is going to take off eventually. And why do I say that? Because we are at a point where these things are happening. These things are coming together. In the sensor space, we have a bunch of inexpensive wearable sensors, the Microsoft Bands, the Apple Watches. We have mobile systems. We're talking about the incredibly powerful smartphones you all carry in your pockets. You all heard we're in the golden age of big data, right? And this is exactly what you need to solve these high-dimensional problems. For example, Google's push and release of their TensorFlow deep learning algorithms. We're beginning to live more and more in a connected ecosystem, sort of cloud computing and the Internet of Things, where all your devices are interconnected. And all of these things lay the groundwork for this revolution in physiological sensing, with BCI being the ultimate goal. And there's been a big push in funding from all sorts of U.S. government organizations, including my own U.S. Army Research Laboratory, in developing this type of technology. I just put a couple of examples of the companies that are involved in physiological sensing or BCI in particular. Facebook just started a BCI research group last year. Okay, so what are the concerns? Well, I have a few minutes left. The concerns implications. So as you know, I work on this technology, I tend to think about what are really the broader concerns. I work for military applications, but these have general implications and concerns for society. I put them in three categories. First, privacy, right? I think privacy is a big issue of a lot of new interconnected technology now in the cloud computing age. So, you know, with our browsers or smartphones, we're giving agencies, organizations, governments massive troves of information. You add physiological sensing and BCI to that, they literally know what you're thinking, right? That's a big concern. Agency. Well, I think neuroscience is very interesting, and I do a lot of different neuroscientific research, BCI being one of them. It does, and specifically BCI, sort of feed into this deterministic materialism philosophy, right? You are the sum of your neurons. The classic quote, my neurons made me do it. If you know the state of the input, you know the activity within your brain, you can predict the output. There is no consciousness is an emergent elusive property. You're really just a stimulus response machine. And then finally, vanity. I think we live in an increasingly self-focused society, and with the addition of these physiological sensors, self-tracking, everything about yourself and how you're performing and how you're interacting with the environment, and leads to this pervasive focus on the self. So as I was thinking about these, and I'm just continuing to think about these concerns, some ideas, some verses came to mind, approaches that as Christians we can take, ideas or philosophies we can take, illustrated through a couple of verses that I that I thought of. So for privacy, in Proverbs, the discretion will watch over you and understanding will guard you. I think this is key, especially for our kids or the younger generation who don't know, don't realize the implications of this releasing and distributing this kind of personal information. Be sober-minded, watchful, your adversary prowls around you like a roaring lion seeking someone to devour, in 1 Peter, again, wisdom about technology. Not just BCI, not just physiological sensing, but a lot of this integrated technology that we're using today. An agency, you know? Are we really the sum of our neurons? Are we stimulus, action, it's consciousness and illusion? Now, the Bible says, and Paul says in Romans, do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind, that by testing you may discern what is the will of God, what is good, acceptable, and perfect. And finally, vanity. Instead of focusing on ourselves, we're called to set our minds on things that are above and not on things of earth. Finally, I'll just leave you with the Philippians, a verse that I personally take to heart. The peace of God, which surpasses all understanding, will guide your hearts and your minds in Christ Jesus. Thank you. Good. Enough time for questions.
So, I don't know how lie detectors work, but can this be used for that?
So that particular study I did, it is hotly debated. Lie detectors don't work. There's no scientific substantiation of what lie detectors. They're a psychological mechanism. They scare the person into revealing or assessing. There's no scientific basis for lie detectors. This is totally different. This is knowledge detection. This is actually measuring the memory trace in your brain. So, yes, in the theory, it could be used, and it has been. The intelligence community has very interested in this technology. There's a lot of implications and concerns for that, for obvious reasons. And so this is being hotly debated right now in the U.S. government's intelligence community, whether or not this is appropriate technology. But it does work.
So what application is obviously interrogation?
Yes.
What's Google TensorFlow? And how many of these things can be used by us?
By
people like us?
Really? So the slide I did is, the TensorFlow is their algorithm that they finally released. So BCIs have a bunch of components, as I mentioned, one of which is the algorithms. Google's very good with algorithms, right? We use the same algorithms they use. They use it on their image processing, their ImageNet, their searches, their speech to text. All of that uses this architecture called deep learning. It's just completely revolutionizing every field that has any sort of computational component to it. I can talk to you later about it, but this is Google's version, the most efficient version of deep learning is their TensorFlow, and you can take that, you download that, you can use it on your own data sets. We use it on our brain data to develop BCIs. But
so it's
not
just an app that you download on a computer and then it analyzes big databases?
You have to feed it to the database. So Google releases their algorithms, they will never release their data. It's not the algorithm that's the $1 billion prize, it's the data that they have.
We know about Moore's Law of increasing computation, and Kurzweil says that in 20 years, we'll be as smart, computers will be as smart as people, if not smarter.
Right.
But then there's a robotics expert who says it might be 100 years before computers. Right. Any feel for it?
Ray Kurzweil is kind of crazy. We got the extremes, right? You got Ray Kurzweil and you got Elon Musk, who's going all over Silicon Valley saying, watch out everyone, stop doing this. You know, we don't know what we're doing. I think there's a fundamental difference between people and machines, no matter how smart they are. So I do believe that this in particular is very concerning because this type of algorithm or approach to learning is beyond human understanding. It's basically giving all the information to the computer, let the computer figure out, and you have no idea why it works. Nobody knows why it works, right? And so that's very, that is concerning sort of philosophically, right? Have we reached the limit of human understanding? But I don't, I'm not worried that the, you know, robot overlords will be coming anytime soon. So I believe that we should be very cautious and discuss the implications for computation, but I don't think it's an imminent threat. I don't think we're at this, when you talk about the singularity. I don't think we're near the singularity. I think, especially from the brain, because Ray Kurzweil is also very interested in neuroscience, I think he overhypes a lot of what can be done, especially from the neuroscientific side of things. So.
Early on in the talk, you had facial recognition.
Yes.
Is that kind of computer work being done to aid assessment of dementia, people, older people with Alzheimer's and various dementias?
Yeah, so this...
They can recognize what they can do, what they can remember. Is that being used
right
now?
Yes. I don't know. That's sort of, so the application of BCI to diagnostic, let's put it in the diagnostic realm, is just beginning. I would say it was originally developed for assistive technologies, for people for communications or for movement, through loss of movement, but now neuroscience and BCI is a particular window on that. It is beginning to be used for diagnostics, especially, I know for sure it is for early autism diagnosis, as similar ideas have been used. I don't know about dementia in particular.
About things like seizures?
Yes, so seizures, originally, yeah, if you go back, again, I only touched on a tiny little piece of this research. Seizure detection has been one of the kind of holy grails of this type of research for a long time. They've made significant progress. It's still a very hard thing to do to predict a seizure in enough time to make it meaningful for the person in which you predicted it. What they're very good at is once it's happening, finding the location of the foci of the seizure, but it's very difficult to give like a, you know, like a 2-3-5 minute warning because it comes on really quickly.
The helmet fits very tightly, and so the privacy concern, it would seem, may not be that real, because in a defense situation, you have a prisoner of war under a Geneva Convention or whatever. So it's actually you would involuntarily give up information. Wouldn't you have to have some distance, like pointed antenna, but in that case, then the signal strength is diminishing in R². Right? So it seems like this doesn't seem that threatening to me in terms of privacy, because nobody can point an antenna at me from across the room to be able to see.
Right.
Is that right or am I wrong?
Yeah, no, you're right in that sense. So I think when I present this, lots of people pick up on sort of the spooky interrogation part of this. But you're right. For the interrogation version of BCI, it has to be voluntary. You have to put something on your head, right? You can't force someone to do it. It has to be totally voluntary. What I mean for privacy is that even now, you can go to the store, you can buy it. This is called a Muse. It's an EEG headset that you use, and it gives you neurofeedback and helps you, you know, reach your organizer chakra or something. But that information about your brain is all goes to the cloud, just like everything on your phone. So as these applications become more common, you put it on, you assess the sensor, you collect the data. As soon as you do that, the data is shared.
That's like when Facebook started and said, I can't believe they're giving me this data. Right now, people are wearing Fitbits.
Right.
But I got a Fitbit. I put a fake name and a fake all this stuff in there, so they wouldn't be tracking it back to me as a person.
Right.
Because you're voluntarily giving all your biometrics.
Exactly.
A cloud.
Yes.
It's like that.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm going to thank our speaker.
Thank you.